From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in early December when Monroe County leaders announced a temporary solution to what many local parents and providers have called a crisis in early intervention services in our area. Those services include, among other things, speech and occupational therapy and special education for children under the age of 4. A shortage of service coordinators and funding would have led to about 1,200 children being placed on wait lists, preventing them from receiving the services that they need. Community members came out in full force, including some on this program, discussing the value of what they call EI, Early Intervention Programs. On December 6th, the county announced a short-term solution. 6 staff members from the Department of Health were assigned to coordinating intake services for early intervention programs. The move ensures that evaluations can continue, but the county is stressing that until the state takes action and increases basically funding reimbursement rates for providers, this is not a long-term solution. Critics of the county say it can do more, and while the state's funding formula is an issue, the county can free up more money to pay for service coordinators. The short-term solution does not require additional funding. But on the county side, they say, talk to the state. That's where this problem needs to be solved long-term. Well, this hour, our guests are discussing the current state of early intervention services in our area and their impact on childhood development. We're going to hear from local parents about the difference those programs have made in families. And all of this is part of our Dialogue on Disability Week here on WXXI, where we highlight efforts about how to create a more inclusive community. Let's welcome our guests for the hour. Beth McClellan is an early childhood administrator at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Diane Kozar, Vice President of Children's Programs and Clinic at CP Rochester and Happiness House. And talking to Diane before the program, a parent, a provider, someone who's kind of walked this story in a lot of different ways. And I appreciate you being here to tell that story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jason Zook, a speech-language pathologist at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Welcome, Jason.
Thank you for having me.
And with us is Bridget Morgenstern, a parent whose twin sons attend the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
How are the twins doing?
They're doing great. They're actually home receiving OT services as we speak.
As we speak. Wow.
Yes.
How old are they?
They just turned 3.
Wow. Okay. So, you know, there's a lot of ways we can sort of get into this issue of what EI is. But what I think I want to do first is just talk very specifically about how this hits families. Because we can talk about funding and really sort of abstract things. But for you as a parent, here you are. You got twin 3-year-olds. They're getting services right now.
Mm-hmm.
Take me through the twin story and how they've kind of come to this.
It's been a struggle. I stay home with them. It's a full-time job, 2 boys. And we learned early on, about 18 months, they weren't very verbal.
Mm-hmm.
And just something was a little off. There was a lot of sensory needs, and they were my first kids. I wasn't sure what was up. Originally, I did ask for early intervention. We weren't approved. At their 2-year physical, we were approved for early intervention. So we started the process, and that was because at that point in time, they had no words. They were very active.
At 18 months?
No, 2 years.
Oh, at 2 years.
We were turned down at 18 months, even though they weren't speaking at that point in time.
Hmm.
So at 2 years, we were finally approved. They came out, did a full evaluation of the boys, and they were approved for OT, special ed, and speech services. That was in January of last year.
So we just passed a year.
Mm-hmm.
What difference has it made?
A huge difference for myself personally as a mother, and the quality of life for the boys. They can communicate better. We're still on a long journey for them. They are not fully verbal yet, but we're making progress. They can communicate their wants and needs much better. They're not as frustrated. It's really been such a great experience for myself to see them grow and develop over the last year. It's kind of like the lights went on. It clicked. They're happy. They're smiling. We're actually in preschool right now. Their therapists actually go to preschool with them to see them interact with other kids. They've gone to a great program called Talk at Rochester Hearing and Speech Center with Jason, in which it's a classroom setting. It's basically a class for the kids, but I learn how to communicate with them. I learn how to do things at home for them to communicate with me, and it's just been a really, really helpful, because it's hard not to get frustrated as a parent. You've got these two screaming, frustrated kids. You don't know what they want. They don't know what they want.
They want you to know.
And you're just standing there and you're like, what do I do? Mm-hmm. I need help. They need help. And early intervention has been able to help us with that.
Well, first of all, as a twin myself, on behalf of all twins, thank you, moms of twins. Thank you, moms of twins. Just amazing. And then I think, and I think Jason will be able to jump in a second specifically on this point. But what I think is probably really challenging as a parent is parents are of young kids are always kind of thinking, well, what's the average benchmark?
Mm-hmm.
You know, some kids are super verbal early, but, you know, motor skills don't really develop until a little bit later. Some are very dexterous, but not as verbal, and things catch up. But as a parent, you're also asking yourself, is this just sort of a normal in that range? You know, and normal, probably the wrong word, especially after yesterday. Typical, let's use that word. Is this typically in the range, or do I need to start intervening? Well, you're looking at 18 months, and you're already saying, should we ask questions? You got turned down. Were you surprised that at 18 months you got turned down?
Yeah, I was.
Huh.
My gut told me that we weren't where we needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone said they're twins, they're boys, it takes extra time, just be patient. But I'm their mom. I knew something wasn't right. So for me, that was very frustrating because I wanted to help. I knew we needed it.
Yeah, and this is where I think I want to ask Jason. One of the things that parents of twins might wonder, and I can think of a family member who has a daughter and then twin boys. The daughter was, I mean, super nuclear verbal before one. The twins are 2.5 and, you know, have a small handful of words. And they were asking the same kinds of questions. And one of the things that kind of came up was, well, is it a little bit of a slower or later curve for twins to get going with certain things? Or is that not the case? I don't know the answer to that.
I don't know if I could speak to actual research. I know with a lot of children that are speech delayed that there's some concerns with other aspects of development as well as just the speech. And I know mom's concerns were very big on that as well. So I can't really speak to whether or not twins tend to be different.
Okay.
I do know that what mom spoke to when it came to her feeling, that her gut feeling, that's really what parents should look at. If they have a feeling that there's something wrong, don't worry about the when it's supposed to happen. Just bring that to your pediatricians, bring that to early intervention, and mm-hmm. and go from there.
And now here you are with the twins are three. Mm-hmm. You're seeing these changes in just over a year's time. What do you think, you know, and this is sort of unanswerable, but I'm sure you've thought about this and you've probably read about this. What do you think the long-term impact is of getting this early intervention versus not?
I struggle. We're doing great. We've made great progress in the last 6 months, but it took us 6 months to get all three services that we need. And I do wonder, I'm like, well, I wonder if we had gotten this at 18 months. Where would we be now? Like, is there a difference? Would we still be as behind as we are? But then again, we're still so much further ahead than we were 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. So we're making progress. It's a challenge. But what I do know is they're making progress, and that's the most important thing.
When you see disputes over funding, when you see talking about a crisis in early intervention. Does that worry you as a mother, and are you thinking about that?
It breaks my heart. There are so many kids out there that are struggling. There's so many parents that are struggling. Do you know how many friends I've lost because they don't understand that, like, my kids are different, that they can't do what every other kid can do? But how many friends I've gained in this community because you need the parent support. Our kids need the support where they can just be kids and do what they need to do at their pace. And the support that we've received through the services and the connections that we've made are so important for their success. And then our success is being parents to these special little kids. And to know that that funding could be lost, or when I heard about the wait list and how early intervention got caught, I said, oh my gosh, like, how can they do that? To think that these people have to wait that much longer. These mothers are home with these kids that aren't getting what they need because they don't know how to communicate or they're having sensory issues, and moms don't know how to deal with it because they're just regular people. We don't know. We didn't go to school for it. This isn't, we're just people.
Well,
it's not fair to the parents. It's not fair to the kids.
Yeah. So we're talking about this as a now issue here in Western New York, Monroe County, et cetera. You know, Diane was saying before the hour began that in, for a lot of providers, the story kind of goes back to what, 2010, 2011?
Yes. In about, I want to say 2010, rate cuts were all providers, including agencies, took rate cuts from the New York State. Early intervention.
Can we talk about your story then? Because
sure.
I think this is really illustrative of what's happening here. First of all, you were what were you doing before you sort of made a switch after that rate cut?
So in 90, I moved back here with my husband in 92, and I'm a physical therapist by license, and I was working with children with disabilities, and went out in early intervention. At that point in time, it was family court, and at my two oldest children went through family court, and so my oldest had speech and special ed and had a preschool program as well, and early intervention then presented itself, and so myself as a provider, being the fact that I had quite a bit of experience, I went out and became an independent provider. Rates at that time set up very similar to how they are now, but just they were definitely higher. We got no rate increases over the, I was in early intervention, so how many years? 15 years or so. Got no rate increases, but we did get rate decreases over the years. So finally in 2010, I couldn't take on any more kids to be able to make the same salary I was making. So I chose to leave early intervention as a provider and joined with Happiness House, which is in Canandaigua and Geneva, and was able to still treat kids in early intervention through Happiness House. They still do early intervention at Happiness House, but only at center-based services because we can't afford to send our therapists out. It just doesn't, we can't, we can't make that connect. We can't, you know, fiscally make that work.
All the way up through your change, how many kids were you working with?
I had probably with, at any point in time, I'd have at least 10 to 15 to 18 on my caseload. And it really depended on how many kids needed services, if I could fit them into my schedule, because I was working in rural Wayne County into Ontario County, and then sometimes in Monroe.
When you think about those kids and you think about families, what happens in those families if there isn't someone like you working with them?
You know, I can't speak enough to the benefits of early intervention. As a provider, often if I wasn't the first one in there, special ed would be the first one in there. Sometimes OT would be the first one in there, or speech. And those families depended upon us. There's so many, they just like Mom was saying, they don't have the wherewithals to know what is right, what's their children should be doing developmentally. And the big push is developmentally. You know, the brain is developing so rapidly at that point in time between birth and five. You see the biggest brain growth occurring. The you know, major milestones are occurring for gross motor, for fine motor, and that all relates to cognitive development. You know, your early reading comes in. You know, it's just there's so many key components that are occurring, but parents don't know all this as they and they're not necessarily supposed to know all that, because if you have a typically developing child, that's kind of just co-concurring as they're developing. You know, so I think that person, that provider coming into the home is a huge social benefit as well to the parents, because we end up providing that support to those families. And that's huge. It's huge.
I think, Diane, just from an outsider's perspective, it's like this amazing sort of discovery and advancement we have in how we care for children that, you know, over centuries and decades, we understand better now how to, when to intervene and what these challenges look like and how to specialize and how to approach them. And yet, now we have so much of this sort of figured out, we're not going to fund it and support it at the level that you know, the families and children would need. I don't fully, I guess, understand that. I'm going to ask you a blunt question. Who do you blame for that?
I think the way they set early intervention up is kind of its downfall. So they took it, and maybe Beth would have some insight into this as well, but I mean, they made it a medical model because it's under Department of Health. They're getting Medicaid funding for it. They're billing Medicaid for those services. So as a therapist, if I'm submitting a bill to the, you know, to, the Bureau of Early Intervention, you know, I've got CPT codes that I'm billing for and that type of a thing, and minutes and all that. They're then trying to recoup that money through insurances and through that right in there is like you're setting parameters on what kind of services you could provide, because as you know, under those billing codes and those billing laws, you have to provide, you have to do, you know, per the billing. I don't believe early intervention under family court, you know, you got to look at the child as a whole, and you weren't under those specific billing requirements.
So if you could change the system, how does it look?
Well, I would like to see that, you know, if there's a pot of money, you know, you're looking at how can you make it so that a provider can go in, provide services, make appropriate referrals, and then, you know, utilize maybe a consult model if necessary. I don't know that there's a good answer. I think that there needs to be much more discussion on what would be a great model for early intervention, but I don't think what we currently have is working.
Okay. I mean, I just made you state director. You got to go in and talk to the governor's administration now. I guess I take the point. This is complex. There's not an easy single answer, but if the current system is underfunding or under caring for children, something must change. Do you think people are serious about it right now, observing the sort of the county battling the state and kind of pointing fingers? And I'm not trying to minimize it. I'm certainly not taking any sides here because it's complex. But do you think people are serious about solving this?
Providers for sure are serious.
Providers,
I mean,
are.
Providers, agencies, parents.
But you can't control all of that.
Absolutely not. You know, I don't know what the state to be honest with you, I don't know. I think legislators are hearing us more than they ever have in the past. But it's also been because there's been this uptick in you know, parents really speaking out. You know, Monroe County has had a lot of providers and parents out there at legislative meetings. I know I was just at a rural county meeting down in Penyan, and they actually were talking about the fact that they actually had parents coming out, and one of their legislators was actually listening to parents talking about the shortage in the rural counties. And that's even, you know, they're even struggling greater than even Monroe County, because as a provider to go provide services in a rural county, you're encountering many more obstacles than you are just in a suburban county.
All right, Beth McClellan, Early Childhood Administrator at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Are you optimistic that we, and the collective we means various governing agencies and bodies, are serious about solving this?
I think it's going to be a long haul. Honestly, right now we've got a fee-for-service model. And as Diane was saying, back in, I believe it was 93, the rates for what your typical visit is an extended visit, which is about 60-minute visit with a child. And that's direct service. So anything beyond what the provider needs to do is included in that amount of money. So in 1993, it was, I believe, $97 or $94. And then in 2003, it went down to, no, 2003, it was $97. And it went down to $86 in 2011, where it currently stays. So in almost 20 years, we've had no change or actual decrease in service.
$86
funding.
For what?
This is for a fee-for-service one-hour visit. So during that one-hour visit, you're face-to-face with the child doing your intervention. But beyond that, you have to travel there. You have paperwork to do. That includes your salary, your fringe benefits, the billing time, the overhead. Everything goes into that. So someone might say, oh, $86, that's a lot of money for an hour. But it's not just an hour. There's a lot of time beyond that hour that goes into what the providers have to do in the community.
And it was $93 in 2003?
It was $94.96 when early intervention started. Wow. in New York. And it was 2003 that it went up $3 to $97. And in 2010, it went down to 88. In 2011, it went down to 86, and that's where it stands.
I know there was a recent study that came out saying that PTs are at about half the rate that they feel that they should be.
Half.
About half of the fee-for-service
rate. The median salary in the area for a speech pathologist or an occupational therapist or physical therapist is about $10,000 to $20,000 more.
Right.
Than what an early intervention provider would receive.
All right, so if it was at the rate it was in 1996, today that would be $156.
Yes.
For a visit, and it's right. 88. So
yes, if you look
roughly
at
half.
Roughly half.
Because again, we're looking at an inflation calculator, and that's from government data on an inflation calculator. So you can't just say, well, it's been the same, because every year it effectively goes down,
right?
Because the dollar goes shorter than it used to. It doesn't go as far as it used to. So now here you are, almost half of what you would need to be. That's why people like Diane made the decision you made in 2010, 2011. But that's a decision you make. That's a decision sort of being forced on you.
Right.
So right now, how many providers, how many people are looking around going, can't do this?
I have to tell you that we've lost 12 providers in the last year. In 2018, we lost 12 providers who love doing early intervention, but they just couldn't sustain it anymore because we can't pay them what they deserve. So half of them went to school districts. A few of them actually went to work with adults. Many of them are still providing services through our agency, but as per diem. So they're getting a higher rate for just seeing the child rather than getting a salary that would include mileage and time to do what you need to do.
And, you know, Bridget is telling the story of her twin sons and the wonderful services they're getting in their first year plus now. But how many Bridgets, how many families are out there who are going to have to wait or not get services now?
And Bridget, you didn't have a chance to say that you did wait.
Yeah, well,
oh,
she
I did.
Yeah, yeah.
You were on the waiting list.
This was a long time coming.
For each service.
That's half the battles. You have to wait. It took 7 months for speech.
Wow.
Even so today, they're still not getting the level.
And even today, so we've transitioned. We're 3 years old. We are still not receiving the recommended services. As I shared, my boys, they're still not where they should be verbally. We still have our sensory needs. And there is not enough providers in the county to provide speech for them. So we have two speech pathologists. We have Jason and Miss Kate, both helping with the boys, and we're still short an hour of recommended speech therapy a week. That's after being in the system for a year.
You want to add to that, Jason? I mean, just as you observe what that means for families like this?
I can tell you that the therapists that have gone with her have gone out of their way to allow the services that she's currently getting. It's not usually best practice to have two different speech therapists come in and provide a therapy service to the same child, just for congruency of therapy services. But relating to the fact that I just didn't have the time, her other provider did not have the time, that it was the only way to get even remotely close to near the amount of time that we felt that the children needed. And I know that there's a lot of other companies that are doing the same thing. They're putting more children in than would be considered a full caseload, working overtime and getting all those extra benefits in to see as many kids as we can, and it still isn't enough.
Okay, and again, looking over the notes on the twins. So a 7-month wait for speech,
mm-hmm.
a 4-month wait for OT.
Correct.
3-month wait for special ed.
Correct.
Even now, that doesn't mean you're up to where you would need to be recommended. Okay.
Yes.
And Bridget's in one of the families that's, quote, getting services.
Yes. So I'm a lucky one.
You're one of the lucky ones.
And we are. My boys have a fantastic team. I do consider myself lucky.
No, I take the point, but it still illustrates the current reality of where
yes.
we are. Let me get Bonnie in Rochester on the phone. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. I was, of course, listening. Yeah, I want to talk about some of the major issues here about, let's call them system issues, that relate the woman, the mother that you spoke to, well, she had to wait for like more than 18 months mm-hmm. to have her twins considered evaluated. Well, the system that we used to have that was funded by the state of New York after the Wilbur consent decree, and I say that because that's the legal piece. The legal piece is often what defines what the state can do and what they can get away with not doing. So that model was we had full interdisciplinary teams. Occupational therapist, speech therapist, social worker, and all the service coordinators, just about all of them, came out of that model because they were to coordinate those pieces so the families could get the services, no matter where you lived, okay? And so what the mother was saying about the, I think it was 18 months, she was noticing something, and that model, which is more of a medical model and probably has a cost factor associated with it in terms of who pays for it. That model was not part of what I'm talking about. If a mother came to us and said, listen, my son's described them and said, I'm having some questions, there wouldn't be any question because it's public. It's a public service. It's a statewide public service. What the state has done, they have chopped these services up and they have divided them so that the things you used to be able to get as a, let's just call it kind of a package deal, and all the things these people are mentioning now, and including when you work for the state of New York, the salary for these for the physical therapists and all those people is it's not outrageously high, but it's much higher, and because that includes benefits and everything. When the state moved to get away from public responsibility, I'm going to use that word because that's what it is, and they get moved to get away from that. They, one of the reasons they did it, and people have to understand this because I know it sounds kind of harsh, but they did it because they didn't have to pay as many people decent wages. Let's not fool ourselves. So over time, you know, new people come into the system that they have now. They don't maybe know this history, but all those things were done as, say, what I am calling for. I spoke at the legislative hearing at the county they had recently, what they need to do. Because the state should be held totally responsible for what they did. They need to have a public hearing where the county and the state call, parents calling it, legislators coming in, and they need to deal with this whole thing. Because unless you get a bigger, kind of more holistic approach, this will go on forever. Thank you.
Bonnie, thank you for the phone call. Some thoughts from our guests. Agree? Disagree? Beth, what do you think?
I agree that things have really been broken into pieces, mainly because that there aren't enough providers around, so children are seen by a variety of different providers. I'm not sure when Bonnie was talking about if this was previous to early intervention coming into play in New York State, so maybe through the family court system. Maybe. I'm a little unclear on if she was talking about prior to New York State implementing early intervention.
But I think she wants some real responsibility brought to bear.
And the state, in my opinion, my personal opinion, it's the state. Monroe County, the administrators at the county are absolutely wonderful, and they feel for all of the providers. They have gone bent over backwards to try to get services for these kids. They've worked with all of the providers to try to figure out how we can maximize what we have right now. So they're really trying, and they're always the bearer of bad news to all of us. I feel for them.
Well, a little bit of information on sort of the county and the state going back and forth. Monroe County Executive Cheryl Donolfo traveled to Albany about a month ago, along with Jeff Kazarowski, who is the former president of the Children's Agenda, asking the New York State Association of Counties to adopt early intervention as a lobbying priority. And she's calling directly on the governor to change the rate structure to make it easier for providers to bill for all of their labor and to release emergency funding to boost reimbursement rates for service coordinators, as well as direct provision of services. Is that a start?
That is a wonderful start.
How far along the road would that get us to not only sort of tying up the emergency problem, but creating a long-term solution?
I think if you can ultimately bill for all the service, just under family court, I think there was probably one, I don't know the specifics of family court because my kids were in it. I wasn't necessarily, you know, a hands-on administrator of that, you know, of those programs. But I think you could, you got reimbursed as a lump sum, basically. You know, you kind of were given a sum. So you could provide the services that you needed for those families and the service coordination. The biggest piece with early intervention, I feel, is that, you know, there needs to be a service coordinator that's kind of coordinating all of those services. They're doing the IFSP. They're reaching out to the parents. They're making sure the providers are getting, you know, their pieces done. They're doing all of the, and there's very little money to reimburse for service coordination. So how do you provide that service when you can't get reimbursed for much of what you're doing?
Yeah, there are two different things that we're looking at here. We're looking at service coordination issue, which you had talked about earlier, in addition to a provider situation. Right. So the service coordinators are the ones who get the children in the door, into that evaluation, get things going for them, and oversee it. I have to say several of the service coordination agencies in Monroe County have recently dropped out of service coordination because of the rates. They can't afford to pay the service coordinators to continue to do that. So most of the agencies that were providing that service dropped out, and that's why the county is now trying to take over that piece of it to have an interim plan to try to make things better or to move things along.
I don't intend to compare children with early intervention needs to adults or anyone with cancer, but in my view, if we had created some sort of a cure for cancer, but then over the last 20 years, we said, well, you can't get, we'll give it to some, not all, we'll put a waiting list on there, hopefully it works out for you, and we're going to have to just cut the rates, it would be a scandal.
Definitely.
Why isn't this a bigger scandal?
Because we're busy taking care of our kids.
I mean, there's plenty of people raising a little hell. Mm-hmm. Why? Because maybe it's more tangible. When you have cancer, you could die from it, and if you could ostensibly create a cure, it would prevent that, and you could see sort of two possible outcomes, living and dying, versus children with early intervention needs. You can't prove a negative. What happens to your kids if they don't get the services? We can't prove what happens to your kids. Mm-hmm. I can't prove that they're going to be better off with this, even though we hear what Jason's doing, we hear what so many people are doing, and it should be obvious to us. Maybe that's part of it. I mean, what do you think, Bridget?
I think it's a valid point. There's no long-term guarantee on any of it. There isn't.
Do you have any doubt that your kids are going to have better lives because they're getting services?
No, they're going to have a much better life.
It's been study after study showing that early intervention and the earlier the better for the best outcomes for your child and also it ends up being cheaper later on in the long run for reducing the amount of cost that it would cost at a later time.
Yeah, I mean,
special education in the school districts is going to cost a lot more than it would for early intervention.
That's another important point here that maybe we're missing. It's not just, well, spend the money now or don't. It's spend the money now or probably spend a lot more later.
Right, exactly.
So what are the other ways, Beth? Let's sort of flesh that out a little bit. We don't spend money on early intervention now. What costs are we looking at down the road? You said, you know, services for, I guess, special ed and other needs potentially.
Right, special education, occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech pathology. When kids get older, their brains are not going to be as plastic. Mm-hmm. The flexibility there, you don't have as much of an opportunity as you do when they're birth to three to make the difference. So things are going to slow down. But if you can get them earlier, then you're also improving the outcome down the road.
I think you see that not only for school, but I think you see that as they're entering their teens and they're entering into the workforce because these kids, as you're trying, I mean, the whole concept of early learning is to teach kids skills, to give them the ability to problem solve, to, develop those cognitive sets, to look at communication, decision making, critical thinking. Those are all things they need as adults to be a productive member of the workforce. If they don't have those moving forward, how, you know, what's their prospect of becoming a member of the workforce as they're 18, 19, 20? I mean, so it doesn't just impact early intervention right now in school age and preschool and then school age. It impacts ultimately, you know, long term. And, you know, how are these kids functioning as they become working adults?
I want to take some of your phone calls after our early break. We're way late for our early break. We're talking about early intervention and the work that's being done in our community despite cuts in reimbursement rates. Essentially, our government's spending a lot less money than would be required to help all the children who need it. And that's the current reality. You're hearing from Bridget Morgenstern, a parent whose twin sons attend the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. They're there right now. Jason Zook, a speech-language pathologist at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Diane Kozar, Vice President of Children's Programs and Clinic at CP Rochester and Happiness House. And Beth McClellan, an early childhood administrator at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Your feedback on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections. If it feels like talking about race is impossible, well, we sit down with a woman who is an expert at helping companies, employees talk to each other, start those difficult conversations, how to have them. We'll talk about it first hour. Then second hour, the Dialogue on Disability focuses on job discrimination. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is our Dialogue on Disability. Teresa in Canandaigua next on the phone. Go ahead, Teresa.
Hi there. I was calling because of a comment that you, a question actually that you had, Evan, earlier about comparing people with children with special needs aren't getting the same type of treatment as, say, like a cancer cure.
Sure.
It was the analogy you made. And that brought to mind an anecdote that I had as a mother of twin boys with special needs. Hi, Bridget. It's Teresa from Mercy.
Hi, Teresa.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Bridget and I have had this very similar experience, and my twins are a little bit older than hers, but when my twins were first receiving their diagnoses, one of the things that a family member asked about, very upset, was where was the treatment plan? Where was the single person who was coordinating care to make sure that they receive an optimal, life experience? Because in this family member came from a medical background, was used to, like, an oncologist directing, you know, from on high, here's the plan we're going to follow. And I believe that the service coordinator is supposed to give that kind of on high, you know, here's what we're going to do, but that's not how it plays out. Mm. In my experience navigating all these different services, different programs, different just work that goes into getting my kids what they need. It's been my experience down here in Ontario County that one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing. I have come to my service coordinator saying, here's a thing that exists that they had no idea it existed. Or my service coordinator has said, here's a thing we're going to do for your kid. And then I go to try to implement that and am told that that no longer exists that way, that they can't accommodate it. They can't, give the accommodation that my child needs in order to be able to do such and such a thing. And that's really nobody really knows all the pieces. So when you ask why is nobody up in arms about this, Evan, it's because we don't have a full picture of what our kids could actually get. There's one agency fields one thing, one agency fields another thing. This camp allows you to have an aid for your kid, but this camp says no, and it's all what you know and who you know and what you have access to. And I'm a little bit more tenacious than some moms, so I get more things than others who are a little more passive. So I don't know how that can be fixed, but there is no treatment plan as it stands currently. And so being all up in arms, sometimes I don't even know what to ask for until I know that it exists.
Well, Teresa, thank you. Yeah, this is so important. So first of all, thanks for taking the time to call, and good luck to you. I think your children are sound like they're very fortunate to have a real. I mean, all parents are advocates.
And we're fortunate that we're finally in the school system too. I feel for Bridget trying to go from one place to another That was a rough time.
Thank you.
We're in school now. And we have a great school district in Camden Bay for them, but it's just nobody knows everything, so we can't quite be as up in arms about this as God. I wish, you know, I could, if I could, may have a list of demands, but I don't even know what everything is.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Thank you, Teresa. Good luck to you. So let's build off that here. First of all, I'll ask her friend Bridget if you agree with her diagnosis there.
No, it's very true. It's been beneficial to have a network of moms who've been in the same situation, because you talk to each other. Okay, here's what my kid's doing. What do you know that's out there that will help? And we share our thoughts. What therapies have you gone to? What places can you go hang out? But on the same token, I go to my therapist for a lot of these questions too. Like I said, I have a great team. I have picked Jason's brain for so many questions. Like right now we're looking at preschools for next year. Which ones does he know about? Which ones has he been to? Our special ed teacher is going to visit the preschools with me. So it's about having the connections and utilizing your resources. But again, I'm friends with Teresa, and I've learned you have to ask the questions and you have to know what's going on. But that's the type of person I am. Not every mom is like this. You have to really have focus, pay attention to your surroundings. And I'm lucky. I only have two kids. If I was a mom with six kids or one kid and worked full time, I don't know how you would do this. This is my full time job. This is all I can do.
I know that Bridget has gone out of her way for her children on more occasions. She doesn't give herself enough credit by any means. And I know that the parent piece is such a big piece of it, and having a support group is such a big piece of it, which I'm not quite sure how she came to know about our talk program, which is actually a parent-child program. And I'm hoping that was what she got from it, more than the ability to provide therapy for the children, because we were using that as kind of a stepping stone into getting her the services she needed. The goal was to provide the training to the parent rather than to provide the direct therapy services to the children. And the parents are such a big piece of it, but not all parents, as she had mentioned, have the ability to do those programs. They don't have the transportation to get them the places that they need. They don't have, they work 9 to 5, so the timing for those programs don't work the way they need them to. So she's lucky in the fact that she has the ability to do these things, and she does advocate for herself. But I agree that a majority of my parents don't have those abilities when it comes to advocating for the needs of their own children.
Well, I've read, Beth, that at least at the Rochester Hearing Speech Center, classrooms are staffed with speech therapists, physical therapist, occupational therapist, special ed teacher, putting a lot of people sort of cooperatively together in the same space.
Yes,
yeah,
we have a couple of different programs for our early intervention age children. Jason's talking about the TALK program, which is a parent-child group, which is run by a speech pathologist. So in that group, it's a parent-child group, and it includes parent training and parent support. So there are a group of 5 to 6 parents together with their children working. And Jason, in this case, is working with the parents and teaching them different techniques that they can use with their children all day long. And that's the goal of our program, is really to work with the parents to teach them what they can be doing, especially in the situation where we are now, not being able to provide home services individually to each child because of the waiting list. There are currently 133 kids on the waiting list as of last week for early intervention services. If we go back to the service coordination piece, though, we were talking, I think our caller was talking about service coordination and how difficult that is. I think because there's been so much turnover, the service coordinators don't even know what's available in the community. They try to get out to visit the different programs. We often have our service coordinators coming out to see our developmental group, which is another program that Jason works in for early intervention. And that is the program that includes occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech pathologists, special educators. We have an assistant. And that classroom is for children who have some pretty significant needs. In there, we also try to have a home connect so that we also are seeing the child in their home and being able to work with the parent, because early intervention is all about working with the parents and the caregivers and teaching them what they can be doing.
Let me get Ryan in Rochester, who's been waiting as well on the phone, wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Ryan.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for letting me on the air.
Sure.
I love your show, Evan. These thoughtful subjects that you cover are just mind-blowing, just how amazing it is with the work that you do.
Well, that's very kind. I wanted to comment on
private versus public, and I'll give you just my quick background in this. So I'm a parent of a child with autism, and I'm originally from Long Island. You may be able to tell through the accent. Just looking at Monroe County compared to Suffolk County, which is where I'm from originally, and where my child was born and diagnosed early, it's a world of difference between the services that are available there and what we've gone through with our transition here. So I just wanted to call that out. I love Monroe County. I love Rochester, but it's way different and way behind as far as services and what's available. And I think part of that might be because there are a few private schools that are subsidized by the county on Long Island that do a wonderful job. And I'm sure they've, you know, fought for whatever funding they could get. And I just think if we did more of that here, we'd see a better result. And the people that your guests and the great work that they do might not be as frustrated trying to retain therapists and find a fair wage for the great work that they do. So I wanted to get your input on that, or your insight on private versus public and how that would work here. And I apologize if you covered some of this in the opening. Introduction to the call.
Yeah, Ryan, thank you. Thanks so much for listening, for calling, and good luck to you and your family. Let's see what our guests have to say. Beth, you want to weigh in on that?
Private, there are some, well, we provide private therapy mm-hmm. at our agency. At this point, we don't have therapists to be able to do that either. Those are not publicly funded programs, so that's out of pocket for the parent, basically. But it's not something that, again, we don't have the providers in the area to be able to do that.
So realistically,
not at our agency anyway. I think some of the agencies that are involved in early intervention would not have the availability to do something like that if we continued to provide early intervention. It's going to be one or the other, or some combination of each. But we do offer that at our agency.
Okay. You agree?
I think, you know, private, you can certainly access insurance. I mean, you know, there's different various ways for parents to be able to access their insurance company. But again, you're then facing the same exact model. It's a fee for service. You have to justify services. You have to then show progress for that insurance company to continue paying. So I'm not sure if the caller was talking about actually like a privately funded via insurance, or if he was talking about like a county program that was developed that's now funded by the county. The county has chosen, like Suffolk County chose to fund this piece of it. You know, early intervention used to be funded more by the state. They've slowly moved that funding. You know, the county's responsibility has increased over the years as far as, you know, how much the county needs to pay.
Well, in our last couple of minutes, I think Ryan's raising an interesting question, because sometimes we get caught in our own bubbles and we think, well, what's happening here is what's happening everywhere. I don't know what's happening in terms of early intervention in Ohio or Long Island or Connecticut or Florida. I mean, is the struggle here reflective of what's happening in a lot of other places, or is it unique to Western New York, or at least the Monroe County region here?
New York State, each state has to determine how they're going to run their early intervention program. So in New York State, they've decided that each county would fund, or not fund, but figure out how to run the program. So in Monroe County, it's basically reading the regulations and trying to figure out how to make everything work for your area. And each area or each county has a different rate. Now, Suffolk County's rates are a lot higher than Monroe County's rates. Monroe County has some of the lowest rates in the area.
Who decides that?
State. The state.
New York State. Mm-hmm. Okay. So
Bureau. I think the Bureau of Early Intervention.
Okay. Again, so if you missed it earlier, our guests are, I think there's a lot of interest in seeing New York State make some changes, is probably fair
Definitely.
To say. There's been a lot of back and forth between the county and the state, but our guest today saying, you know, a lot of this is at the state's lap, and we'll see, because again, County Executive Cheryl Donolfo went to Albany along with some allies on this issue to tell the governor and to tell the legislature, you can make these changes, but you know, it's got to be a commitment, and it has to be a long-term solution. And our guests have really painted, I think, a couple of pictures, maybe a bit of a gloomy picture of the state of local of funding for the providers doing the work locally, but also a very sunny picture about what happens when you do get the intervention. And I want to thank all of you for telling this story this hour, because we need to continue to follow it. And I think it's voices like yours that help us understand it as part of our dialogue on disability. Beth McClellan, early childhood administrator at the Rochester Hearing and Speech Center. Thank you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us, Evan.
And Jason Zook, speech-language pathologist there. Thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our best to Diane Kozar, who is the Vice President of Children's Programs and Clinic at CP Rochester and Happiness House. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Bridget Morgenstern, good luck with the twins.
Thank you.
I really appreciate you taking the time to tell your family story. Good luck. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Rob Braden is the engineer of Connections, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon. We're back with you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.